I'd like to go on now. This is Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 114. It's B. We're on page 417. I was talking a bit about the cardinal cross and the idea that every point in the triangle has three streams of energy. Each point of a triangle emanates three lines or streams of energy, nine in all. I think the implications are tremendous. They are intricate. If we look at the picture of the cardinal cross, we don't see exactly that, at least in this particular picture. We see every line, every point of the triangle emanating one line. But I seem to have run into some symbol or some description in which each point emanates three lines, and thus the three becomes the nine. We'll have to hunt for that, and maybe it will come up in our discussion and in the text itself. DK tells us, actually, it is useless for students to attempt to unravel this aggregation of interlacing streams of energy. At least it is useless now, with our present faculties. All that is now possible for man with his present equipment is to accept hypothetically these statements anent certain major triangles which affect humanity and seek to prove their effect and to endeavor to arrive at some understanding of that intricate interwoven network which he himself possesses and to which he gives the name the etheric body. So if we can somewhat understand the intricacy of the etheric body, we can transfer this understanding to the larger cosmo system. It is, I suppose it's humbling, isn't it, to think of this intricacy, to think of the complexity and how little our minds can grasp all these energy threads, their effects, their combinations, the effects of their combinations, the way so many factors are related and interrelated. I guess we just have to grasp the general principle. But DK does seem to say that it is possible to seek to prove their effect upon humanity and perhaps upon individuals, and to endeavor to arrive at some understanding of the etheric body. Thus, he may succeed in proving, first to himself, the accuracy of a statement by the demonstrated quality of the life aspect, its conditioning and result in the microcosmic life history and events. So we can begin to see how some of these systemic and cosmic forces, as attenuated as they are when they reach us, how they do have an effect. We can somewhat prove the accuracy of the larger picture and the assertions about the triangles in that larger picture. So we have to make these things real by a kind of self-proof. Prove the accuracy of within our own system. I know some people who do that. I mean, they use themselves as the instrument to demonstrate the reality of certain energies which they could not touch except for the impact upon their own system. They could not perceive what these are, these greater triangles are in their true nature, but because they can prove that there is an effect, they can at least infer that the triangles do exist. This astrology has naught to do in connection with tangible happenings on the outer plane of existence. This is the second time he has stated this, although every interior state will work out. in something more tangible. This astrology has not to do in connection with tangible happenings on the outer plane of existence. We, however, will see to it that our effort lies along the line of psychological life history and events, and not along the line of physical occurrence. And this is part of the astrology of the soul. The psychological astrology is a reflection of the astrology of the soul, and quite a number of psychological astrologers have emerged on the scene, not so much interested in proving the timing of events, though sometimes the timing of events can help one rectify the horoscope and prove to oneself later the psychological validity of that horoscope. We want to always have a rectified horoscope, and sometimes the outer events are useful in gaining an accurate picture of the horoscope as it exists with the proper time of birth, the truly proper time of birth. Anyway, this astrology has not to do with, in connection with tangible happenings on the outer plane of existence, though the psychological life history will work out in tangible events because, you know, as the old saying goes, character is destiny. The difference is basic and must ever be borne in mind. I worked with a man who was quite a mathematical astrologer, wonderful astrologer in the mathematical sense, and he just didn't have so much use for the psychological and humanistic astrologers. He felt that they were all basically ill-trained in astrology and rather vague in their understanding of the real mechanics of astrology, which maybe they were. But both are needed, really. I've come to respect that. I've come to respect that that esoteric astrology is the foundation, but it doesn't hurt to be trained in the astrology of the form, the exoteric astrology. There can be a productive reciprocal interplay between the two. The difference, however, between these two lines of astrology is basic, and the science of triangles is having everything to do with not with the tangible happenings at all, but with the inner state of things. Remember, the triangle hovers above the square, and the triangle has everything to do with consciousness, with soul, with triad, with monad, and not with the square of personality per se. This difference is basic and must ever be borne in mind. Astrologers have to begin to grasp a dim idea of the interlocking triangles of energy as far as our Earth is concerned, in the rather arbitrary division of the 12 constellations. They have begun to grasp this in the rather arbitrary division of the 12 constellations into four triplicities, meaning if this configuration is arbitrary, it is a somewhat forced view. We do have the fire, earth, air, and water signs, but apparently these are rather rigid categories to someone with an understanding of esoteric astrology such as Master DK has. So we astrologers, we've begun to grasp the dim idea of the interlocking triangles through the elemental triplicities. Through the elemental triplicities, let's see, have I erased something I shouldn't? Yes, I have. Okay. To grasp the dim idea of the interlocking triangles of energy as far as our Earth is concerned, in the rather arbitrary division of the 12 constellations into four triplicities, four elemental triplicities covered by such qualifying terms as earthly or earthy triplicity or fiery triplicity, composed each of a cardinal, a fixed, and a mutable sign. There is a kind of a triplicity here too, with the cardinal, fixed, and mutable, with the three gunas, you might say, sattva, rajas, and tamas, although they are not precisely capable of being overlaid the one upon the other. They thus divide up the entire zodiac into a fourfold group of interlacing and interrelated triangles, each conditioned by one basic element and thus qualified. Although each one of these signs in a particular triplicity is also related to the guna triangle, it will be either a cardinal, fixed, or a mutable sign, even though it belongs to a one element. These constitute a series of basic triangles with a definite reference to our planetary life. One wonders if it can extend beyond our particular planet, but we have in the earthy triplicity a reference to the dense physical plane. We have in the watery triplicity the reference to the astral plane. In the fiery triplicity, the reference to the lower mental plane, and perhaps the higher mental plane as well. In the airy triplicity, interestingly, we have not only the Buddhic plane suggested, but also our own systemic etheric level, the four systemic ethers, not the four cosmic ethers. But in a way, they are both ruled by air in a general sense. So the elements connect us with different dimensions of our own energy system and of the Earth's energy system, and the kind of motions, forms, aggregations, deaggregations, basic quality of motion and magnetism, density, etc., that are found on these levels. Owing to the constant movement everywhere, we could almost call it perpetual motion. Owing to the constant movement everywhere inherent in the solar system and the zodiac, onward, interior, and revolving, so everything is progressive, and then there is an interior relatable motion, which is probably related to the second aspect, and revolving to the third. I would say that these three motions relate to the three aspects, three aspects of divinity. Whenever we speak of the interior, it seems like the second aspect is involved, and revolving suggests the type of circular motion of the third ray. So onward is progress. Onward, the interior motion is probably spiral cyclic, and revolving is the rotary motion. Owing to the constant movement everywhere, inherent in the solar system and the zodiac, and really in all of the cosmos, and even, you know, if you think about it, the great breath is perpetual motion. It is a motion which is ever occurring and has no beginning and no end, and that's the great mystery. No cause, it simply is. So perpetual motion exists when there is a cosmos, and is the cause of cosmos itself. Without this motion, there would be no cosmos. And yet pure beingness is, in its essence, motionless. So we're faced with a great paradox there. Some idea can be grasped of the intricacy of the entire pattern, and it's going to be, I think we can see, a dim idea. If DK calls our apprehension of the four triplicities, elemental triplicities, just a dim idea, then we can only imagine what our idea must be of the intricacy of the entire pattern, which, of course, you know, part of which is that which is seen by the astonished disciple. Astounded or astonished disciple at the third degree. He sees the passages of energies as if from the as if from the mountaintop. It's probably a particular way of taking the third degree. I don't think that those on every ray necessarily see the great passage of energies. It seems to be more a third ray, second ray type of realization at the third degree. A further aid to the grasping of this essential beauty of coordinated and organized movement and its power to qualify and condition the entire universal pattern can be gained by those students who have studied somewhat the various triangles to be found in the etheric body of man and the interrelation of the seven centers to which I have referred elsewhere in my various books. So, you know, the astronomer with his extended means of vision can see deeply into the universe, but probably does not grasp the manner in which the universe is organized according to triangles and centers. And yet, DK seems to be hinting that there is there is a strong analogy between the structure and dynamics of the etheric body of man and the structure and dynamics of cosmos. So, in this case, if we study ourselves, which increasingly we are coming into a position to do, we may be able to transfer what we learn to our estimation of cosmic structure and dynamics. I'm sure that our own etheric triangles reflect certain powerful triangles, influential triangles in our own local cosmos system and in systems beyond. It's the holographic view where the basic structure is reflected in a descending manner in forms which are parallel to the original but are rather less in focus than the original is. Okay, the seven centers, etc. These centers, when awakened and alive, are swept finally within the radius of each other's sphere of action. From the point of view of living energy, the circumference of these wheels or vortices becomes so enlarged that they eventually overlap and touch, and the interlocking series of triangles presenting on a tiny scale a condition analogous to the contacting and interlocking series of triangles such as those referred to above. So in our etheric body, we have potential triangles and those which are and those centers which come into triangular relationship with each other because their spheres have touched and begun an interaction, a triangular interaction. Right. So in many cases, I suppose we have triangles in the etheric body which are latent, they are potential, and they have not swung into full vivification and triangular interflow. One such is the healing triangle surrounding the head, the Alta Major, the Ajna, and the Crown Center. And the healer must achieve purity through purity of life. He must attain that dispelling radiance which shows itself in every man when he has linked the centers in the head. When this magnetic field is established, the radiation then goes forth. So the centers in the head are completely linked here, the major three, When the third initiation is taken, and then the third eye finally comes in the center of the head, finally comes into really active usefulness. But at first, there is not the interflow between these points, not completed in any sense. And look at the triangle of Shambhala, hierarchy, and humanity. DK has a place where he shows the flow of energy between them, and as yet it is an incomplete flow. Might be that I can find that and show something of his of the point that he is making. Well, here precisely is that diagram that I was looking for. And we see that in the past, Shambhala and hierarchy had a relationship, and the Shambhala energy flowed towards hierarchy, and hierarchy's energy flowed towards humanity, and humanity attempted to reach Shambhala, but it was an incomplete attempt, as the arrow indicates. For the present day, it's really different. Humanity is not attempting to reach the God-kings directly in Shambhala. It's attempting to reach hierarchy, where graduate human beings can be found, and some of those, well, now they are all human beings, I guess. They all have replaced the original Kumaras. Shambhala, for the first time, through its impacts, is attempting to reach humanity unmediated by hierarchy. And hierarchy, interestingly, has not completely reached Shambhala. In the future, it's a completed triangle, and every triangle has indicates, every point indicates it's involved in reciprocal action. It's not just going forth or something attempting to reach it, but there's a flow from it and a flow to it. And this we clearly see, don't we? Well, you can imagine this with the various triangles of our etheric body, because I think the story will be somewhat the same in the developmental history of these triangles. And when they are completely developed, there will be a reciprocal interplay. At first, it may be that the first aspect simply tries to reach the second, and the second the third, and the third doesn't reach anything much, but attempts to reach the first. And then maybe later, the first and third aspect come into direct interplay. The third aspect tries to reach the second, and the second attempts to reach the first. Eventually, the interplay is complete, and there will probably always be an evocation at the center of a completed triangle. Something will turn up here in the middle, which will be the fourth point. The tetrahedron will be completed, and the point in the center will rise to an elevated position. So, that should give a fairly good idea of what we can expect within the etheric body of man, and what is really going on in the surrounding cosmos, could we but have a vast enough comprehension to grasp the interplay. Now, DK will make us aware of some of this interplay, but we can understand that the various triangles he may point out may be in different stages of completion. Not all of them having reached the third and final stage, where there is reciprocity between all points. Behind these concepts of the relation existing in time and space between the constellations of the Great Bear, the Pleiades, and the Sun Sirius, he's being specific, isn't he? He's not saying, you know, the Sirian system. He's talking specifically about a solar logos and its manifested star, Sirius, and our solar system, which is the, let's call it, the point of manifestation. There exists, it must be remembered, an immense series of interlocking triangles between the stars which compose these constellations interiorly and our solar system. What an amazing and vast perspective we're being presented with here. We are just looking at a small group that emerges as a triangle and to which the vast system of interlocking stands as a huge prototype. So we're dealing with what we can handle, the Great Bear Pleiades and the Sun Sirius, in relation to our solar system and hence in relation to our planet. But there exists, it must be remembered, an immense series of interlocking triangles, relationships of which we can have no idea. We look at a fixed star and we say, well, this is its influence. But have we any idea of the way that that particular star may be related to two other stars with which it forms a triangle and perhaps with many such other pairs? It would be astonishing to see this, and I think at the third degree one may be presented with a vision of intricacy and interlocking, but not with the whole picture. An immense series of interlocking triangles between the stars that compose these constellations interiorly and our solar system. One thinks about, could there be two stars in every system, every constellation that link in some way to our solar system? There probably is this. One of the stars of the Great Bear allied to one of the stars of the Pleiades allied to our solar system, a triangle produced there. But the number of triangles that can be created, well, some mathematician can figure them out. We have a very good mathematician associated with this general work, and I know that he would be able to take certain constellations, their given number of stars, and the possible number of triangles that could be created between themselves and between them and our solar system. Someday I'll have to ask him what he might do with the seven stars of the Great Bear, the seven stars of the Pleiades, and our solar system. And the different planets would be also involved there, as well as our sun. The planets in this case, I suppose, would form a kind of a fourth point. Two stars, two constellationally related stars, our solar system, and a fourth point, the point of reception, the planet. You have, therefore, a relationship between the seven stars composing the Great Bear. Of course, there are many more stars in that constellation, but those are the seven major stars. Every constellation probably has seven major suns, I would say, and just the way every solar system has seven major planets and a number of others, just the way there are a number of other stars in a number of constellations, but seven major. Of course, when you look at Sirius, unless it is related and part of related to and part of the seven solar systems, of which ours is one, it cannot be cannot have seven stars within the Sirius. The proximity of the star Sirius, there are not, as far as we can see, seven other stars. But if we relate our sun, Alpha Centauri, maybe Procyon, and certain other ones, depending upon the opinion of the astrologer, we will have the possibility of a sevenfold system in which Sirius is involved. So there, you have a relationship between the seven stars composing the Great Bear, the seven stars composing the Pleiades. Well, not really composing the Pleiades, but the seven most prominent stars in this great cluster that we call the Pleiades, sometimes called the seven sisters or wives of the Rishis, or informing lives of the Great Bear, and these Rishis then would have a special magnetic relationship, one each to one of the Pleiades, according to ray. So since we more or less know the rays of the stars of the Great Bear, we have to determine the rays of the Pleiades. And when Nicholas Nalen and I were teaching some astrology courses, we made some attempts to do this. I'm not sure whether they should be considered definitive assignments, but at least we realize that there would be a ray connection between a star in the Great Bear, according to its ray, and a star in the Pleiades, according to its ray. And we're speaking of the prominent stars of the Pleiades. There are really so many hundreds. And the sun Sirius. Sometimes I think the sun Sirius could serve as a blind for the Sirian system. We'll have to ask whether, put it down whether this is so. Is this a blind for the sevenfold Sirian system, or these seven solar systems of which ours is one? Okay, these compose major triangles of force and are all held within the radius of the life of that great being whose expressed manifested intention is brought into being through the medium of these three related groups and our solar system. I think in this point, DK is speaking of the one about whom not may be said, the superconstellational Logos, who has chakras as his constellations as his chakras. Okay, so we're talking about interrelationships between these three, and note there is the implication that Sirius is a sevenfold system. At least I get that when I read this. There may be an implication here that Sirius is really a sevenfold system. If so, is this the seven solar systems of which ours is one? And I think Sirius is so close to our Earth and to some of these other stars, neighboring stars, that I think it could be considered the case. Sometimes Sirius is considered all by itself, and sometimes I believe it should be included in the seven solar systems of which ours is one, inasmuch as it is, excluding Alpha and Beta Centauri, the closest star. And proximity must mean something. Okay. Well, Sirius can be considered sevenfold, and in which case we'd have interlocking relationships between 21 major stars. Or there could also be 14 stars, major stars, seven of the Great Bear, seven of the Pleiades, and the Sun Sirius, and our solar system. I do think there is a relationship between the Pleiades, the Great Bear, the stars in those constellations, and the stars of the seven solar systems of which ours is one, as found on page 50 of this book related to Taurus and Scorpio and to Mars. If the two major constellations of Sirius, of Great Bear and Pleiades, are related to the different planetary logoi in our system, I see no reason why they should not be related to the stars, the seven stars, in the seven solar systems of which ours is one, to which each one of our planets is most closely related. For instance, like I would say Jupiter is most closely related to our particular sun within the seven solar systems. Venus most closely related to Sirius. I'm talking about sacred planet relationships. Maybe, well, it's just a speculation. But maybe Mercury is most closely related to Procyon. And my colleague Nicholas feels that Fomalhaut is part of the seven solar systems. Maybe it is, I'm not sure. But if so, Neptune would be a likely candidate for the closest relation there. In other words, if the major stars of the Great Bear and the Pleiades are closely related to planets, why skip a step? Why should they not be closely related to the group of stars to which our particular planets are most closely related? DK tells us about the intricacy of all this. He says, we will not unravel it. It's like taking an immense tapestry filled with millions upon millions of threads and trying to somehow disentangle all this so one can come to a complete understanding. Later, the intuition, which will have full and comprehensive and intricate grasp of things, will reveal far more to us than we can with our present reasoning minds. So, these three compose major triangles of force. These compose major triangles of force and are all held within the radius of the great being, the life of the great being, which I am assuming here is the one about whom naught may be said, our local one about whom naught may be said, which, you know, I think is this one right here. This little triangle here on this fantastic map on page 344 or so of Cosmic Fire, Chart 5, Chart 5. I think that's the one about whom naught may be said, our local one. And if this is true, then there are 49 some ones about whom naught may be said, and seven comprehensive greater beings, each of which contains a one about whom naught may be said, and a cosmic parabrahman that contains seven of the sub-parabrahmanic parabrahmic logoi, each one of which contains seven ones about whom naught may be said. There are so many different interpretations of this particular map that, you know, I'm not going to say that the one that I presently hold, that interpretation I presently hold, is definitive. But I've worked on it, and I do believe that the triangles do represent a one about whom naught may be said. Otherwise, there would be no reason for the seven rishis of the Great Bear, which together are one of the chakras and the one about whom naught may be said, should be coming out of that little triangle, the third triangle, which Keith Bailey, as he worked on these charts, colored in a certain way, giving us a certain color code, which helps us understand the ray configurations. And if it is indeed true that the third triangle here is green, it is telling us a lot about our fundamentally third ray Pleiadian source, out of which comes the various sevenfold constellations. At least they all have seven major points in them, one of which is the Great Bear, or the seven rishis. Well, these maps are intricate, and to my way of thinking, there's no reason why these seven should not be on the cosmic atmic plane as a more authentic source even than the Buddhic plane. But that's another matter, and DK put them there for a good reason. Okay, not to get off on too many threads or tangents. Okay, as hinted by me in a treatise on cosmic fire, these four groups of stars? Interesting. Our solar system is a group of stars. Well, some people feel and have done some research to the effect that every one of our planets is really, in a way, a star. One of which, or more than one, has actually been a star before. Retrogressed? I don't know. Mars, that is. There are four groups, and are each one of them a group of stars, or are there four factors listed here, four sources listed here, only two of which are groups? Well, Sirius is a kind of group, if you consider it by itself, because it has a Sirius B, a white dwarf, I think, connected with it. That's a kind of a group. But from another perspective, a Sirian system would definitely be a group of stars. Now, is our solar system a group of stars? Sometimes our solar system is strangely referred to as a constellation. So as hinted by me in a treatise on cosmic fire, these four groups of stars constitute the manifest aspect or personality of a great and unknown life. Now, is this the one about whom naught may be said, or perhaps a lesser being? We have to leave that unanswered. Is this the one about whom naught may be said, or a lesser being? Because from a certain perspective, the manifested personality, let's see, the Great Bear for the one about whom naught may be said is a series of head centers. And the Pleiades is what? Well, as a whole, may be connected with the crown center, but in terms of its seven major stars, perhaps with some sort of jewel, in the center of the zodiac being the heart and the head center, but having a central jewel that the seven Pleiades might represent in a way, with all of the Pleiades representing the crown center. There is also some throat center connection which has to be worked out, and some have considered the seven Pleiades, at least, related to the throat center, though it's hard to imagine how the crowning stars of such a vast system would be related to a lesser center. That, of course, has to remain mysterious for us at the moment. But perhaps there is a being. What nature? Of what nature? I don't know. A being for whom the Great Bear is the mental body. Sirius, the astral body, the Pleiades, the etheric body, and our solar system, the dense physical body. That would be a personality demonstration. Now, if we think about it, when something is an entire vehicle, it is playing a bigger role than if it is simply a chakra, because vehicles include many chakras. So I conclude that the being here referenced is smaller than the one about whom naught may be said, because these various factors play a bigger role within it. The greater the being, the factor will play a proportionally lesser role. Well, okay. So there is a great and unknown life. Now, we could say it's the one about whom naught may be said, because that being is certainly unknown. But I'm reminded of the time that D.K. talks about who is the initiator of man at the sixth initiation. He talks about an unknown existence. If the planetary logos is the initiator of man at the seventh initiation, The being concerned has to be a lesser being than the planetary logos and probably contained within its ring past knot, and yet it is still unknown. So, well, you know, I'm thinking if analogy holds true, there may be three correspondences to the three persons of the Trinity surrounding the one about whom not may be said. There are three Buddhas of activity around Sanakumara. There are three persons of the Trinity around the Soto Logos. If we go even higher, we're going to find, I think, some kind of synthetic three surrounding the one about whom not may be said, and maybe these three constellations are as planets are to one of the three persons of the Trinity. I mean, you may remember in Esoteric Psychology around 99 that Saturn, Mars, and the Earth are grouped together as representatives of a great third ray entity, which I think must be the third person of the solar logoic Trinity. Well, if you carry that same analogy further, maybe there is a being who is a much higher correspondence of the three persons of the solar logoic Trinity, who is that compared to our one about whom not may be said. And each one of these beings, let's go to a map here, you know, to try to make this easier. There it is. Notice how the three surround or are in relationship to the one, and the three are in relationship to the one. Well, if this were the one about whom naught may be said, then there would be three great super beings, each one of which expressed through three major constellations, which were higher correspondences to the planets through which these three beings express. That being, of course, we do have a fourth being there, and that is our solar logos, making, in a way, the dense physical body. If our solar logos is a dense physical body, to this being must really be something. Well, anyway, you know, that is speculative, but we have to keep our sense of proportion if we possibly can. You have a constellation. It is tiny compared to some beings and larger compared to certain lesser beings. And if it plays a larger role in a being, that being is lesser than the being in whom this constellation plays a smaller role. And a chakra, playing the role of a chakra, is definitely a smaller role than playing the role of an entire vehicle in which many chakras are contained. Well, you know, we go back to the whole idea that we cannot possibly unravel all this. Where does he say it? It is useless for students to attempt to unravel this aggregation of interlacing streams of energy. Well, we can pull at a few threads. Pulling the threads of life, I stand enmeshed within my self-created glamour. It says, what does he say? I see naught else. I'm leaving out one. Surrounded am I by the fabric I have woven, I see naught else. That's it. Pulling the threads of life, I stand enmeshed within my self-created glamour. Surrounded am I by the fabric I have woven, I see naught else. Well, we can pull at a few threads. Have you ever faced a tangle of wire and just wondered where it was all leading? I do a lot with electronics and long wires that help me connect this with that, and sometimes they get tangled up. And sometimes I'm presented with a laborious task, which is anathema to any Aries type, who's always in a hurry, to untangle this mess. And only with the greatest of patience is it possible to trace where one part of the cord goes and how it might be extricated from the other parts. Well, what we're talking about here is a far vaster tangle to our limited minds. Of course, to some great deity, it is a perfect beauty and order and makes complete sense. And to us, until we develop those faculties, we cannot tell whither and whence the various threads go and come. All right. Now, where are we? We've gone quite a bit. Okay. He says, I seek in this connection to give only a general picture because with these cosmic triangles I have no intention to deal. I guess they are so far removed from humanity and especially from the individual that even their effect on humanity is slight, and upon the individual until a true initiate, very slight. Their realm of effectiveness includes more the planetary logoi and the solar logoi. So except to stimulate the mind and to help us say, my goodness, what an extraordinary picture, maybe there isn't so much profit in dealing with them. As I oftentimes say, we can deal with all these things, but we haven't even controlled our astral bodies, so that gives a sense of proportion. We will only consider those constellations within the greater zodiac which are known by astrologers to have a definite effect upon humanity and upon our planetary life. Of course, there may be others which have an effect upon humanity and our planetary life, and which are not known by astrologers, but DK seems to be limiting the picture to make things as practical as possible. Make the study as practical as possible. Yes. Therefore, in studying these triangles, we will make for our guidance certain rules which, under the law of analogy, may facilitate our comprehension and underlying meaning, our comprehension of the underlying meaning and truths. Rules and the law of analogy to help us study a vast subject in which we would become hopelessly lost if we tried to study the entirety of the subject. So we'll just take the limitations that DK places upon this study and realize that even studying the few triangles he may have selected is going to be a tremendous task. I remember once, I may have mentioned it, that I decided, what would happen if I took every sign of the zodiac and matched with every two others? To give you an example, Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Aries, Taurus, Cancer, Aries, Taurus, Leo, blah, blah, blah. You know, then Taurus, Gemini, Cancer, Taurus, Gemini, Leo, and so forth, so forth. And I thought I came up with some interesting ideas. Somewhere they are recorded. I think my daughter transcribed them, if she ever got that far. I think she may have. And somewhere in some desk, long removed from the place where it should be, and probably in storage somewhere, is the description that I had of those combinations. I guess maybe it was an exercise in futility if I cannot find them, and even if I could find them, could I sort it out, and even if I could sort it out, would it be of any use to anybody? These are the questions that people with a strong third ray have to ask, whether the activity of their mind is leading to something productive and useful, or whether it's just an exercise in mental gymnastics ultimately futile for any practical application. A staggering thought, which I won't dwell on at the moment, as it might might find it depressing. All right. So we're going into a new subject here. Certain rules, etc. Maybe I'll just mention them at this time and then get into a greater elaboration of them when I take up 114C. All triangles studied will be regarded as expressing a major conditioning energy producing manifestation. This corresponds to the monadic aspect. A secondary qualifying energy producing consciousness. This corresponds to the ego or soul aspect. And a lesser expression of force producing tangibility, and this corresponds to the personality aspect. In a way, I think we can see this in the triangle which represents the spiritual triad. Here, the monad has its two lesser points on the same level. Whether this is technically accurate or not, I don't know. I think DK did want to draw an equilateral triangle, which to me is the symbol of the first ray, because you don't get a proportion when you compare the sides, you just get a unity, a one. But when we look at the triangle representing the etheric, spiritual triad, we do get a first aspect, second aspect, and third aspect representation. So that is a question about the monadic triangle, you know, whether wisdom should be maybe a little bit higher, maybe in the middle, you know. Or if, but then you wouldn't have the equilateral triangle, and I think that's very, very important. So in every triangle, there will be a monadic correspondence, an egoic correspondence, and a personality correspondence. I think this will serve for most triangles. I wonder if there are triangles in which the two other factors are of some equivalence and are more or less on the same aspect. But there are so many that, you know, maybe later we'll discover that. We have to go with the path of simplicity first. It's probably wisest. These three energies will be related, therefore, to the three aspects of manifested life. And these have been termed throughout this treatise, life, quality, and appearance. Remember, the treatise is fivefold. The astrology part is just part of the treatise on the seven rays, which is a fivefold treatise. Interestingly, five. Five being the number of the soul and of the second ray, and the number of illumination as well, and also the number of the ray which really has to be used to separate out all these energies and see exactly what they are. Number three, these energies change within themselves. And sometimes one will strike the dominating note and sometimes another. It doesn't mean that, you know, activity or love will finally be dominant, but in any time and in any space, one or other may be the dominating factor in the triangle. Sometimes the secondary energy will become a major conditioning force. Now that's precisely the point. And sometimes the lesser expression will come to the top because for the cycle, and become for the cycle the outstanding characteristic of the triangle. Well, this we've explained in terms of fire by friction, solar fire, and electric fire. No way in those early years, millions of them as well, that either solar fire or electric fire is going to be the dominating factor as far as the consciousness of man is concerned. Some cosmic events are governed by the law of expediency, which I suppose relates to the third ray. To the third ray, evoked by the evolutionary process, and the will to evolve is the third ray will, an incident also to the zodiacal movement, and its own interior mathematical conditioning. A subject of such vast dimensions and mystery that no life within our solar system has more than sensed its significance. So the planetary logoi have to go to school to learn something about the results of this great law of expediency on the third ray, I think, evoked by the evolutionary process, an incident to zodiacal movement and its own interior mathematical conditioning. DK's mind is reaching way beyond what even here a planetary logos can fathom. Is our solar god, Sol or Helios, considered to be a life within our solar system? Is he included? Or is it only the secondary ones which are included? And then the cyclic expression of life is dependent upon constant mutation and infinitely changing processes. I'm so sensitive to the word infinite and infinitely, and I wonder whether DK means literally that or just of such great number as to be incalculable. Well, I don't know, and I'm not going to know immediately, but it does raise a question. So this law of expediency, the zodiacal movement has an interior mathematical conditioning. Evolutionary process, an incident also to the zodiacal movement and its own interior mathematical conditioning. The movement of the zodiacal constellations and all the interior parts of the zodiacal constellations are mathematically conditioned. Talk about mathematics. And no life within our solar system has more than sensed its significance, how certain events in cosmos are evoked by these movements. Big subject, right? Well, as stated, this second part of the book, and the most important part of the book, really expands the whole consideration, doesn't it? So, this will be the end of Esoteric Astrology Adventure 114B, page 420, and the beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure 114C, page 420. It leads us off into vast speculations, but hopefully they will do something to our perceptual apparatus, our mental apparatus, in such a way that we will be more sensitive to what must be contacted in the spiritual triad and be able by the Antikorana to apply what is contacted to improving our lives here below. Okay, so I'll get on to this shortly, very shortly.